This episode of Science Studio originally aired May 1st, 2011.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to a professor of geosciences. In particular, we're going to be talking to Melanie Barnes. She's a professor of geosciences at Texas Tech University in Lubbock. And Melanie, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's nice to come back to El Paso. I actually spent some of my time here getting my PhD.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Well, I didn't even know that. Well, yeah, indeed, welcome back. And it's nice to see ex-students who have done well and coming back. So that's an extra bonus for us and for the listening audience. So that leads into then, well, how did a nice lady like you become a geoscientist? What was the beginning of your sort of quest to be a scientist?
Well, I would say my first love was being outside, and I grew up with a family that went camping. I actually grew up with a mother who's a geologist, although she was a part-time geologist. And when I was growing up, well, you know, you're going to do your own thing, not do what your mom does, not do what your dad does. But they instilled in me, as did my grandparents, a love for the outdoors. And I loved Girl Scouts. And if you did science, you got outside. And I really loved my science classes and was very, very fortunate to have excellent science teachers.
Where did you go grow up?
I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and I went to school at Langley High School. That's where I had some excellent science teachers.
That's where the CIA is, right?
Exactly. That's who my dad worked for.
Oh, interesting. So, career. Did he travel a lot?
He worked in Washington, D.C., and then spent 2 years in Vietnam helping the South Vietnamese set up their intelligence agency, and we were in Taiwan at the time.
Okay, so you had quite a nice tour of the world as a young lady.
A little bit, yeah.
Right.
And a lot of the U.S. As far as camping and getting to see rocks and outdoors. And so that I decided early on I really, really wanted to run a nature center.
Yeah.
And someone said, well, you need a master's degree. And I said, okay.
Point me in the right direction.
Right. And so I went on to get an undergraduate degree, thinking I would get it in biology. And at the institution I was at, there was some biology faculty that didn't get along with the other biology faculty. And you go, oh, I just don't want to mess with this as a student. And so I veered into chemistry, found that I had a knack for running analytical equipment. And from there, decided I'd like to do earth science. It was just at the time I was in college from 72 to 76, and I was in high school from 68 to 72. So that was the time where we got the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Earth Day, and mm-hmm. all this environmentalism. They were just starting environmental studies. We didn't have one at Mount Holyoke College, where I got my bachelor's degree, but I combined chemistry and geology and got a double degree. And I really liked geology because it applied chemistry.
Right.
Chemistry wasn't abstract. You know, it wasn't just ideal law this, ideal law that.
and given all these techniques, I mean, just isotopes, you know, differentiation of different elements. And you learn so much now that you could never have dreamed about, you know, 50 years ago.
Well, and that's what I found, that I'm continually learning. And so
yeah,
isotope
abundance analysis.
No, yeah. I have an inductively coupled plasma spectrometer. We just got our third one. And so it's a new generation.
Right.
And therefore, every method I've been using for the last 25 years, I have to redo.
And one of the things that happens, I mean, people who don't do science don't always realize this, but, you know, you go back and sometimes reinvestigate work that you thought you'd finished, because the technique that you're using is now so superior that you can hone in much more directly on some interesting features that were lost before.
Actually, that's true. My husband and I are doing this. We go back in his PhD area in the Klamath Mountains in California, and he has a student who's now tearing apart the geochemistry of a mineral called pyroxene, and this is letting us determine what might possibly have melted to form the magma or contaminated the magma that formed the igneous body she's looking at.
Okay. So you are indeed reinvestigating your husband's work. Yours is sacrosanct. Yours doesn't need reinvestigating.
Well, actually, mine does, but there's not that much.
Well, tell us then. I mean, that's a sort of nice segue into what aspect of geosciences are you really concentrating upon?
In my own work,
yes.
Although I haven't had a chance to do it in a while, I'm an igneous petrologist, and I'm very interested in the basement geology, which would be the crystalline rocks that are exposed here in the Franklin Mountains, but buried 2 miles deep up in Lubbock, Texas, where we are. And they're buried maybe 4 miles in some of the oil and gas basins. And so I'm interested in the structure of or in the geochemistry of the basement in eastern New Mexico and west Texas. And there's a unit or provenance, I guess it would be a better way to put it, called the granite rhyolite provenance.
Rhyolite.
Yes, and granite
what
and rhyolite.
Rhyolite.
Well, you have the Thunderbird rhyolite here up in the Franklin Mountains.
So it's a pretty red rock.
And it's explosive igneous rock.
Okay.
And granites are the ones, that's the magmas that stayed under the ground and actually solidified.
So is this rhyolite, mainly iron?
No.
When you look at this, then you see the sort of
you
reddish,
see the
ox-
yeah, the iron has
iron.
Oxidized, but right. It's not mainly iron. Rhyolites are actually about 70% silica. And then they have some iron and magnesium,
right.
Just depending on what the magma was that they came from, what was melted to form them.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about this granite rhyolite province is that it actually goes from Finland all the way down here to southwestern U.S. And it seems to be a continent-forming event. And it started...
You mean Finland and El Paso are on the same chunk of
a similar
stuff?
Type of
is
rock.
Is the same plate?
No, they're not the same plate.
So there's
but
a discontinuity
similar type of
somewhere.
Rock. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not a continuous belt.
It's not continuous.
Okay.
Actually, the Atlantic has opened and closed several times since these rocks were formed. The rocks that I'm looking at are 1.4 billion years old, about 1.8. Yes.
Okay. And
the ones
in Finland?
The ones in Finland are about 1.58 that are of this composition.
Okay.
And the ones in... As you come towards the El Paso area, they would be getting younger. And there are rocks exposed in the Carrizos Mountains that are also buried under Lubbock, Texas, that are the same units.
Lubbock, Texas, this is a burial ground for a lot of things.
That's right.
Okay.
We have a lot of sediment
so
between
what's so
us.
Fascinating about this particular rhyolite deposit?
Actually, the reason I decided to go back to school in 1994 to get my Ph.D., and since my husband and I are in the same field, he couldn't be my advisor. But since I was working at Texas Tech, I needed to keep my job there. So Dr. Libby Anthony said that she would be my off-campus advisor. And we had an opportunity through my on-campus advisor, Dr. George Asquith, to look at a section of rocks that had been collected in the 30s, 1930s, 1940s, when the oil and gas industry was first looking for oil and gas, they would go down and they would sample everything. And we had a beautiful collection of rocks that went through the granite rhyolite terrain from up north of Amarillo. Because in that area, you're only 2,000 to 3,000 feet deep because there's been an uplift. And so there's only 2,000 to 3,000 feet of sediment on top of what I want to look at.
Right.
And so they had a beautiful collection of rocks. And it was a chance to get a three-dimensional look at what the basement might actually look like. And so from that, I was able to develop by studying the petrology, looking at the geochemistry and the mineralogy, what little I had. You have to remember these are teaspoon-sized samples.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a little bit of gravel that could fit in a teaspoon, and that's your sample.
Yes.
And from that, you can tell a lot.
From that, many theses are evolving.
That's right.
Right.
And so that was my initial work, was to kind of document what it looked like. And we also discovered that the rocks...
But if you'd had a sample from here, mm-hmm. would it have looked any different, apart from the weathering feature?
In the Carrizos Mountains, the same unit has been deformed because two continents collided.
Tell me where the Carrizos Mountains are.
They're near Van Horn
okay.
in that area. So
okay.
east of El Paso.
Yeah. And then west of Van Horn.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I only know that because...
Well, wait a minute. So right there, you said that this is on the edge of two continental pieces?
No. What it is those rocks were squished when two continents came together. The colliding continent was offboard towards the southeast, and it would have been south of Austin. Okay, so a colleague of mine in Austin had a student who was looking at these rocks. And I went down to visit her, and she said, would you please look at his rocks? And I looked at him, and I said, well, Sharon, these are my rocks, squished, deformed. We would call it deformed in a geologic term.
A lesser quality rock.
So what happened about these rocks were essentially formed and erupted and intruded about 1.38 billion years ago. Okay, the Franklin Mountains were formed and extruded and erupted and intruded about 1.1 billion years ago. So they're younger. At the time that the Franklin Mountains were being formed, there was a collision between two continents. So the older rocks got squished. And the Carrizos Mountains is where they're now exposed for us to look at. Enchanted Rock near Austin is also of the same similar age to the Franklin Mountains, and they're part of that whole event that's going on. So we have three pieces exposed of the older rocks that are 1 billion years or older, and the rest of them are buried in Texas. And they're buried in New Mexico until you get to the Sandias. But those rocks are a little bit older. They're 1.42. Now, some people would say, wow, you know, that doesn't sound like much difference, 1.4 and 1.42 or 1.38. Yeah, we throw these numbers around.
You had the billion.
But you have to
end,
think and billion. Right. And, you know, most of us only think in 10 years.
So from the point of view of the intrinsic interest, you know, you've got this deposit, and it's in, well, it's not a deposit, but this igneous intrusion all over the place. And you can, presumably, you can drill holes all over West Texas and eastern New Mexico and, again, find this.
If you go all the way to the
and
Crystal,
so
yes.
What's the point?
The
what
point
are you going
is,
to learn
from what
by
we...
digging up in a different place, right, what you've already seen somewhere else, so to speak?
Well, the reason to do this type of study is, one, we can't see it, so we don't know what's going on. So we have a couple of what we would call remote sensing techniques we can use. And some of that is geophysical, and I'm not a geophysicist. But the geophysicists have been looking. They've got a couple shots and a couple lines. They've done some experiments where they've essentially made the Earth quake and recorded it.
Right.
Or they've recorded what happens when an earthquake does happen somewhere else. How does the ground react? And so from that, they have determined that there's something in eastern New Mexico and West Texas. There's a difference between the Sandia Mountains and what I see in West Texas. And so we're curious as to whether it's a major structure. Is it a major fault? Was it a rifting of the continent a long time ago? And is that still causing what we see at the surface? I think if you look at the Rio Grande Rift, we have a rift there that was just 26 million years ago. It's very young. You know, it's not that 1.1 billion stuff. It's that 26 million. And so our question is there something in the subsurface we don't see that's being reactivated? Is there a reason that there are certain oil basins and they exist in different places with highs between them, like the Central Basin Platform that exists between, I think it's the Delaware and the Midland Basin, and between those and the Permian Basin. And so the Permian Basin has a lot of oil and gas. Is there some sort of structure that has created the basin and then given the right conditions to form the oil and gas? I mean, you don't get oil and gas in every basin. Even if you had plants and animals in those basins, if you don't get a trap for it, then it leaves. If you don't get the right heating conditions, then it doesn't make oil and gas. And so the kind of basic science geologic question is, why is it like that?
And presumably the corollary to that is it likely to be another one, but it's hidden under 3,000 feet.
Right. And one of our questions is, are there basins that are deeper that we should go investigate for more oil and gas? Because we used to think that the Precambrian didn't have oil and gas deposits. And now we see the same structures underneath these granites and rhyolites that are oil and gas basins.
So another gas boom. Anyway, you're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Dr. Melanie Barnes, professor from the Department of Geosciences at Texas Tech, and we're talking about geoscience. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. We've known that diabetics who use artificial sugars to control their disease don't always see a positive result, but doctors had no idea why.
It seems to contradict logic, since they're not actually consuming sugar, but a recent study explains why. Artificial sweeteners change the resident bacterial population we all have in our gut, known as the microbiome.
The experiments first showed that sugar substitutes such as saccharin and sucralose fed to mice elevated their blood sugar levels more than mice fed sugar. The next study looked at whether artificial sweeteners changed the gut microbiome and, in turn, the blood glucose levels.
After a 9-day treatment with saccharin, the mice gut bacterial population shifted dramatically and increased their blood sugar. The bacteria shifted to a group called Bacteroidetes and declined in another called Clostridiales.
This change has been associated with obesity in mice and people. When they gave these mice antibiotics, which wiped out those bacteria, you guessed it, there was a reversal of blood sugar effect from the saccharin.
But what happens in people? A study of 400 people found the gut microbiome of those who used artificial sweeteners was vastly different from non-consuming ones.
A small group who consumed high levels of it for 7 days ended up with high blood sugar levels. These studies show that artificial sweeteners may cause glucose intolerance instead of preventing it.
It's also clear our gut bacteria could play a role in diabetes. And in the future, treatments based on altering our microbiome will expand.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell here with Professor Melanie Barnes from the Department of Geosciences at Texas Tech University. And we're talking about some of the things that Melanie's been looking at, these various interesting deposits that are all over the place, but on the surface in El Paso, but 3,000 feet buried in Lubbock. But that was old work. That's an old study that you did. What is it that you're currently really excited about? Because I can imagine that, you know, one rhyolite after a time is much like another.
Well,
that's
actually,
not true. I know it's
I'm really interested to get back to the basement research, but I've been sidetracked. We were funded to purchase a laser ablation inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer. So the exciting thing about this is...
So let's just tell the audience that you shine a laser on something, you ablate it, you put it into the vapor phase, and you measure all the materials in terms of the ions, and they have a mass-to-charge ratio, and that helps you analyze what's in there.
That's right. And the cool thing is that you can do it on a solid. And the other cool thing is you can take a slice of rock and you can pick the point on the mineral you want to do it. You don't have to take your rock, dissolve it, and then say, wow, I wonder where all those little iron things, molecules were. Were they in the pyroxene? Were they in the olivine? Were they in the feldspars? We can actually pinpoint where they are.
What's the size of the pinpoint?
It can be from 100 microns down to 15. And it depends on what elements you're going after. For example, apatites.
It's 10 to the minus 5 centimeters. Is that correct?
Yes. I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's tiny.
Those math things. It's very tiny. And there are people using it to mark gemstones, and they don't leave a mark you can see.
Ah.
So think of it in that perspective.
Also, it's like a dog tag for, you know,
you can actually identify them, and you can actually analyze them and determine whether they're synthetic or not synthetic. It's one of the techniques people are looking at, and you can also mark
your initials on KP. How fascinating!
Yeah, and it won't detract from the stone,
right? And nobody will know it's there.
Nobody will know it's there but you.
Anyway, so you've got this wonderful tool. What are you trying to do with it?
With this new tool, there's a couple exciting things that we can do. We can actually truly take apart a mineral. As I said before, we've gone back to my husband's PhD area, and he has a student that's doing that. And she's finding that a certain mineral called pyroxene has a different pattern depending on which of – if you have a magma and it melts, the rocks that surround it get included. And they have a chemical signature that then goes into the magma signature. The thing that a geologist wants to do is discover, is that signature from the surrounding rocks or is it the major body? Okay. How much does it influence it? And in this case, we have a magma that has been intruded into 4 different host rocks. And so she's trying to figure out if, one, can she tell which host rock's contaminated, and two, does this give her a clue as to how that magma chamber built? Did it melt all at once, or did it come in little batches?
So,
and then did those batches mix?
And so how do you do that?
What we actually do is she's analyzing different spots on the pyroxenes, and she's analyzing pyroxenes from both the host rock and from the magma body that she's looking at and from different parts of the magma body. So there's a lot of field work to go with it because you have to be comfortable that you understand where you can see the rocks, the relationship between the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you get fooled.
When you're doing the analysis, though, is it just a matter of composition? So much iron, so much silicon.
Actually what we're looking at in particular is a rare earth patterns.
Okay.
Because rare earth elements are included in lanthanum, lutetium, things like that are included differently in different minerals depending on what pressures and temperatures you're at in the magma. certain elements like to go into certain mineral structures, certain elements because they prefer to be in the mineral structure versus the liquid. And certain elements also go at different times depending on the pressure and temperature.
Now, the lanthanides, history, I remember, have got a phenomenal range of isotopes. Well, we actually do some mass spectrometric analysis on lanthanides. And we use holmium, I think, because it doesn't have – it's the easiest one to do mass spectrometry because there's only one
isotope.
So it's very clean.
And we're actually looking at the clean isotopes, too.
So what's
because – and basically because the instrument I have is a quadrupole. And the quadrupole is like having a Volkswagen instead of a Lexus. I don't have a multi-collector where you could look at the different isotopes.
Oh, but it's iconic.
Acid ability, so, but I can do it. So and anybody else can come in and use it too.
Okay. So and, you're looking then at the composition, just the amount of the lanthanide in different parts of this little sample.
And for example, monazites, this little mineral called monazite that crystallizes last, they prefer the heavies. Whereas garnets prefer the light, rare earth elements. And
now,
so,
tell the audience why a different mineral would prefer. Because
it has to do what will fit into the crystal structure and the size,
so size
of the element. Yeah,
okay, because the lanthanides have this very nice contraction.
Right.
You know, lanthanum is very big, and you get to the other end, lutetium is relatively
smaller,
and there's a gradual – I mean, it doesn't wander around.
Right,
it's
and
almost
so
a straight line.
And so that gives a pattern. Depending on which element is included in the mineral, then you will get a particular pattern if you analyze all those elements and you plot it on a graph.
Right.
And that's what we do. And we plot it against a standard. Everybody uses the same standard. So when you look at a pattern from one pyroxene that came from the Alps or a pyroxene that came from somewhere else, you can compare the patterns.
And are they the same around
the
world?
Well, if they've been in the same conditions, they're probably the same.
Okay.
But what we're finding in this one particular magma body that it appears – we still have some testing to do – but it appears to be indicating the host rock that was included into that part of the magma. And since it's a large magmatic body, you're going to get different squirts of magma at different times that have different compositions. And that's what she's trying to sort out. So in conjunction with this, you take a small mineral called a zircon. And zircons like to put uranium into their structure but not lead. And uranium decays to lead. And we know how long it takes for uranium to decay to lead. And if you can detect that ratio, then you can get an age for that zircon.
Now, when it takes the uranium in, there are all sorts of different forms of what we call oxidation states and things of this nature. What type of uranium do you know it is? Is it – this is for the cognoscenti, but, you know, uranium 4+, 6+, can you detect the differences in any
– You know, manner? I don't know for zircon because – and I know that Nguyen would be able to answer that because she's been reading them.
Okay, okay, it's just
I'm not sure which part that is.
Okay, so carry on.
But it's the thing that's interesting is zircons usually do not react. So if you have a magmatic body that forms from another magmatic body that's older, you might actually have some information in that zircon in the core of it about that older body, and then it will make a new rim on the outside of the zircon crystal and give you information about the younger body.
I see.
You might also get information about the sediments that are being melted because zircons don't break down in the environment. They get collected into sediments, and you get this what we call detrital zircons. And so they give you information about what was eroded to form that sedimentary deposit. And then if you bury that sedimentary deposit and you melt it, some of that information may still be left. And so that's the sort of thing we're looking for to help us out with – you know, when did this body form? Is it made up of one magma? Did it take a million years to do it? Did it take 10,000 years?
So this is really fundamental science in
it
a
is.
Sense.
It is. It is basic fundamental science.
When you write your proposal to the NSF or whoever funds this, you don't have to put these paragraphs about solving the energy problem of America.
They'd like to see benefit to society, yes.
So but, what is your benefit
to society? Basically, the benefit is the more you know about where a magma body forms and how it forms and what temperatures and pressures it forms under, the more the material scientists can use that information to say, oh, if we need a harder steel, we should have this type of material, or we should form it at these pressures and temperatures. Or if we take this type of material, it will last through these types of temperatures. So they can take the basic geologic information and apply it in the material science world. So there is some interaction. There may not be that much interaction between material scientists and geologists, but they would be using each other's information. There are times when we look at things that they've done and said, oh, okay, we should be at these pressures and temperatures because when they did their experiment, titanium stayed in the solution or it left the solution. You know,
so, I mean, some of the, in the geosciences department up there, do you have people doing experiments, taking zircon and putting it in different environments?
No,
and,
we don't, and unfortunately.
But, I mean, that would be
but
a
that would be something someone, yes, there are people doing
or collaborate
that.
With people. I mean, mm-hmm. geologists surely are the most collaborative worldwide people that there are, right? Because you always want to bugger off to New Zealand to see something or somewhere.
That's true. It's a small community, and you know people in a lot of different places, and I spend time chatting with people in different places. One of the best meetings I get to go to is the International Spectroscopy Meeting. I've only gone twice, but I've met people from all the world, and there's only about 400 or 600 of us, mm-hmm. and we all speak the same language. We're all analysts. But
right.
There's some other cool things that this instrument can do that are directly applicable to environmental problems and issues that we've been able to work on.
Well, I mean, you brought that up at the beginning, you know, the environment and all the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, if there is one, I'm sure there is one. And the trouble is, going back to this development of instrumentation, we're getting so clever at getting to lower and lower and lower and lower thresholds for accurate measurement.
Yeah.
And people are beginning to realize, it seems to me, that nothing is pure, all right? Nothing is pure. You know, you want to have organically grown potatoes, and you'll find sooner or later there's bound to be some lead in there somewhere, or some mercury, or some arsenic. I mean, that's one of the issues that the public have to deal with, in a sense, it seems to me, because we know we can analyze and find almost anything in anything.
That's correct.
And that gets people very worried.
And that's where I think it behooves scientists, and I think scientists are getting better at this, to lend their expertise to the public policy arena and realize that they have something to contribute. They say, yeah, we can measure a part per trillion. But is a part per trillion hazardous? Then we do the toxicology studies. We say, no, only one out of 10,000 little baby frogs died. So it's not hazardous or whatever the study is. And I've been involved in one with titanium and nanoparticles. And so in that respect, I think we have to help teachers and the people teaching our children science and ourselves as scientists to say, here's what we know, and here's the limit as we know it, and help people understand that we're not trying to hide something. We're actually trying to give enough information that a public policy can be made that's the best for everybody. You can see Japan struggling with this right now with the radioactivity.
Mm-hmm.
What's dangerous, what isn't dangerous, and we all know certain levels we can handle for a certain part of time. I mean, the human body can do that. If you don't have calcium and you have arsenic, it puts arsenic in your bone structure. And you just have to be careful not to overload with calcium so then all the arsenic pops out at the same time and you get poisoned.
Hey, Melanie Barnes, we've come to the end of our allotted 28 minutes or whatever it is. Anyway, again, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
And Norma Martinez, thank you for editing all the mistakes that we've made that the audience never gets to hear. And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.